I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we feature on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. So we want you to be a part of this show with us. So please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and maybe the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu, and maybe you'll hear him on the show someday. But today on Teacher's Lounge, it's my conversation with Joey Brewer. Joey's the new Dean of Students at the Spoon River Valley School District, and he has spent the past two decades teaching history and social studies at rural schools in western Illinois, the region of the state often known as Forgottonia. And inspired by that, Joey started the Forgottonia Project, a student-led local history initiative. They organize oral histories, discuss local literature, pursue local journalism, pen social commentaries, podcast interviews, and loads more.
Because that's another thing that we're addressing, not just that there's not a lot of room for local history and not a lot of room to see yourself in the learning, but we are probably dealing with, and I've seen this in my years in education, at the same time, the most disengaged generation from school, but I really think we're dealing with one of the more creative generations of school. So a lot of my experience has been this process of, man, how can I let go of traditional ways of approaching the classroom and learn to trust my students? And that's the journey that I've been on as well.
Joey and I have a really great conversation about the unique challenges and advantages rural schools face and how you teach students to confidently ask questions, and when the goal is making your students more curious about their community and more empathetic with the people in their lives, how do you measure success? It's a really fun, sometimes pretty existential chat that I hope you enjoy. But before my conversation with Joey, we have one more story we want to share. The Illinois budget impasse began 10 years ago. Lawmakers significantly cut funding for the state's Monetary Award Program, or MAP grants, for low-income college students. And I got to report on how MAP has rebounded in the decades since. Northern Illinois University sophomore Michael Coker shows his friend around campus, posing for a picture in front of the Husky Pride sculpture during Welcome Week. His friend just transferred from community college, and Coker says if it wasn't for getting a MAP grant, he would have taken that same path.
Because then I could at least, you know, work my way through college. Because NIU is a little expensive, I mean, compared to Kish at least. But the MAP and FAFSA stuff really was a big decision in coming here.
He's not alone, and NIU Enrollment Administrator Sol Jensen says for many students, MAP doesn't just decide university versus community college.
If we did not have MAP grants, there are thousands of students that very likely would not be able to go to college.
And MAP funding has grown a lot since the budget crisis. In fiscal year 2016, the state appropriated $170 million for the program. In 2025, the state budget devoted over $700 million to MAP. And Jensen says that's been important, particularly at a school like NIU, where nearly half of the students receive MAP. He says the funding increases mean not only do more students receive financial aid, but the grant amounts themselves are larger. 8 years ago, the maximum MAP award at NIU was about $4,800 a year. And now it's over $8,000, so not quite doubled, but close. And he says to really understand what exactly that means for students, you have to put it within the context of the cost of tuition and fees.
You go back a decade, the MAP grant, at least at NIU, was covering about 38% of tuition and fees. Today, that is covering about 60%.
Jensen says another thing to note about MAP is that it's a first-come, first-served system. And during the budget impasse, funding just ran out quickly. So at NIU, it meant that around 10% of students who qualified for awards didn't get any.
But really now, when you look at the last 5 years, as the governor and the legislature has put more funding into the MAP grants, what we have seen is almost a one-to-one ratio, so that almost every single student that's eligible is also able to receive it.
This financial aid is also pivotal for many community college students. Patrick Pyre is the VP of Student Affairs at Rock Valley College, where over 1,400 students receive MAP grants. That's double of what it was during the impasse. And he says the average award amount those students receive has also nearly doubled. Their students are now receiving the most money they've ever gotten through MAP.
$500 in any given semester can make or break a student's ability to successfully complete a term and stay enrolled.
He says that's especially true for community college students who often choose to attend because they don't have a ton of money to spend on a university.
One of the main drivers of people who decide to attend and then take that break, whether it's a semester or 10 years, most oftentimes they're citing something to do with a financial shortfall.
The average family income of students receiving MAP is $33,000 a year, and more than half of eligible students have no extra money to pay for college. And despite those financial hurdles, a report from the Illinois Student Assistance Commission shows that MAP recipients graduate college at similar rates to all students at their institutions. And there are other forms of financial aid, like federal Pell Grants and merit scholarships, but at schools like NIU, the maximum MAP award is still larger than Pell and larger than any merit scholarships or other financial aid. Back at Rock Valley, Pyre says that the program, which was so unstable a decade ago, now provides much-needed stability. But with state and federal finances in flux, the question is if the increasing investment will continue. All right, now it's time for my conversation with history teacher, dean, and the founder of the Forgottonia Project, Joey Brewer.
I love stories. I think that's been a big thing that's driven me about school and education. It's why I love schools. I love stories, and in many ways, educators, teachers, we are stewards of stories. And every person, every school, every community has some awesome stories. And in rural areas, I've learned we are rich in stories. So a little bit about me too. I'm actually from the Kankakee, Bradley, Bourbonnais area, if anybody knows that. I'm kind of a non-traditional dude. I've migrated sort of in the backwards pattern. As we see a lot of rural youth leaving small towns and small towns kind of population are declining, I got my first teaching job and I went from a metropolitan area down to a rural town in a little town called Cuba, Illinois, 3 hours from that Chicago area where I'm from. And I've absolutely loved it. And I think a lot of folks don't... Huh? Yeah, honestly, immediately too. And you know, one of the first things about Cuba where I taught, and I've taught in a few different rural settings out here, and I still live in Cuba. I'm talking to you today from Cuba. My wife is a teacher from Cuba. We're a one-car family. My kids would go to Cuba. That kind of life is it's awesome. You know, there's definitely some challenges I want to can share about rural areas, but a lot of folks don't realize how incredible it is. Cuba was actually the first green school in Illinois. And it's something, it surprises you when you drive by our school in the middle of nowhere. You know, there's this school with, you know, solar panels, which we are finally updating because we used to put those solar panels next to the baseball field. And so there has some like, you know, baseball shattered things here and there. But as that technology is developed, you know, we have to develop with it too. But there was just such a environmentally conscious seeds planted in kind of a school, building a school that we inherited. And so this was back in 07, you know, my first year teaching and just kind of learning how Illinois really is full of this rural, diverse culture and history. Illinois has a rural population that would fit be bigger than 12 states. Majority of our school districts, our 852 school districts are rural. And so, you know, working in this context, too, is kind of like, how do we give a space for our students to ask questions about their local history, right? Local history, especially this rural history, just wasn't really represented in that public memory. I always struggle to explain to this to people, what is Forgottonia? Should I talk about that for a minute? What is when we say Forgottonia?
Yeah, why not? Let's dig into it a little bit. So that'll give some more context about what the project's about. Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So there's this influence of students are not having a space in school to learn about their local history. You know, it's not exactly in a textbook. It's not exactly represented. And I'm from outside of this area, and I'm like, wow, there is so much rich history here. And we just have, you know, the world of schools got these mandates and things like this. And so we kind of put this framework of this 16-county region in Western Illinois, which is often referred to as Forgottonia. And a real quick rundown of the Forgottonia story, a lot of people might have heard of it, but it was in the early 70s. There's this feelings in the area that people are neglected in this area. They're ignored by state leaders. And so there was this satirical movement to secede from Illinois and form a 51st state of the 16 counties in rural Western Illinois. And that state was going to be called Forgottonia. A Western Illinois University theater student named Neil Gamm was recruited to be the governor of Fort Gatonia. And this guy would dress up in this, I think he borrowed an Undertaker coat from a friend, and he had this like fancy bow tie, and he would take these hilarious pictures in front of some dilapidated old buildings or some rusty cars, decaying back roads, to sort of highlight this kind of contrast, right? And man, this story became like a viral sensation. It was told everywhere. The story was shared. I think the New York Times even picked it up. And so it got kind of big. And here's a weird thing too. A lot of folks might have heard of, there's an old book called The Mouse That Roared. And it was kind of an in vogue book and movie around the time. And that was really the influence. So if you've ever heard of Peter Sellers, he was in the Pink Panther movies.
Yeah.
I always think of like the movies like Nutty Professor or Austin Powers, where one comedian like Mike Myers is playing all the roles. Peter Sellers was in this movie called A Mouse That Roared that everybody was laughing at that day, where he represents a fictional country that declared war on America just to surrender immediately, but get foreign aid. And then that money for foreign aid would turn around their economic problems. So this was kind of the satirical fun idea. We're going to succeed, but then get money from, you know, this aid, and then it's going to fix all of our problems. So it was just kind of a joke, but it really did become a sensation. And still to this day, people refer to this area as Fort Gatonia. I think it's turned into a much more lovely or endearing term.
Right. Like people own it now as like a fun cultural nickname. And also,
yeah,
like kind of a clever twist, right? That like by saying that you're Fort Gatonia, it does make the region more memorable, right? Like you're there making you sure people
absolutely
don't forget it,
it
by referring that way.
Yeah. And the goal the whole time really was the whole time to make that term obsolete, to make it not needed. And it did have some sincerity to it of not just we need some money for infrastructure, for roads, but we need to bolster our education. We need to address our mental health abilities. Neil Gam himself, this college student, was a Vietnam veteran, you know, and he kind of saw all these things as well. So it really had a lot of meaning. And I just kind of use it as a context to give my students permission to ask questions about this region, to really take control of their learning, because that's another thing that we're addressing, not just that there's not a lot of room for local history and not a lot of room to see yourself in the learning, but we are probably dealing with, and I've seen this in my years in education, at the same time, the most disengaged generation from school, where there's a lot of boredom, there's a lot of not seeing myself in this learning. Yeah, a lot of distractions. But I really think we're dealing with one of the more creative generations of school. So a lot of my experience has been this process of, man, how can I let go of traditional ways of approaching the classroom and learn to trust my students? And that's the journey that I've been on as well. So anything my kids want to ask questions about, it could be the specific Fort Gatonia story or just something about the history, the culture, some of the issues that they're inheriting. That's another thing to think about. Our young people might be inheriting more issues than any other generation before. And so that they ought to have space to kind of, learn about these sort of things.
So what does that space look like? Are we talking about, like, obviously we talked a little bit about the project itself, right? There's the podcast, there's kind of oral histories, there's the whole website where you have various different resources and things like that. From the student perspective, what does it look like in terms of, again, like, is it a club? Is it a class, community group? How do you think of it that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's all of those things, man. It is all of those things because as we've tried to create a space for it, we've kind of found that our traditional approaches, our systems of doing education can kind of not always be conducive for that. So the one sort of pedagogical influence I've had more than anything else is I read a book called Make Just One Change, Teach Students to Ask Their Own Questions. And so really that space is all I care about. I created a history club, and some of the probably the best projects that are like publicly digestible for these things to share are students that have done this work out of a history club. And we really just created that space because when you are driven by your own curiosity, you know, it's not necessarily for seat time, for a credit. And so what I've found is I have students that want to do this that aren't assigned my class that semester, right? And they just want a space to do this. And so we have a history club, but we've never really had consistent meetings of today history club is meeting, you know, 3 o'clock, whatever. I have students that are incredibly busy. They just have questions, and we just would always try to figure out how we're going to address them in little ways in here. So it's this process of teaching students to ask their own question. And shout out to a guy named Dan Rosting, and he had another partner on a team at something called the Right Questions Institute, but they have this method called the question formation technique where you do some things to prompt curiosity and really think about the questions that you want to answer. And from there, I do make one regular trip with some students to the Western Illinois Archives, where we work with, a shout out to John Hallwitz, Western Illinois' most prolific author, but he helps the kids out individually to say, here's some awesome primary sources you can look into about the questions that you have. And the students try to find someone who they can talk to. And we need to learn how to communicate effectively. And so that can be so, so messy and complicated on when can you do the talking? And students are also developing those skills of, right, when can you schedule something? How do you write an email to someone or maybe make a phone call to someone? And even the failure of those that experience is so much learning going on, right? It's so much learning going on. Well, so
the thing about that I think is so fun for me particularly also, right, is what you're describing – having a question about your community, diving in to try to answer that question, examining primary sources, doing research, doing interviews, and then disseminating it to the community.
Yeah.
That's journalism, right? Like, that's what you're asking to do is journalism.
Absolutely.
And I'm fascinated particularly, like, you know, about not just giving students the platform to ask that questions, but the confidence to ask those questions about their community, right? Like, I think all of us are naturally curious about the place that we live, right? Like, we literally, we drive around, we walk around, we see things that we're like, I wonder why it's that. Like, I grew up in Sandwich, Illinois, you know, rural, rural school. It's also like, you know, what is rural, right? Like, I grew up in a town that's, you know, my backyard is a cornfield, but we had 7,000 people. There are, I know plenty of friends that are exactly. Like, that's basically suburban at this point.
Right, yeah.
but anyway, we drive around and we're like, oh, you guys have this, you know, one of the oldest county fairs in the state. How did that happen? How did that get there? Or, you know, there's other small communities around us and, you know, that are a lot more, you know, like racially diverse than our town. Why is that? And so, again, I think that all of us are naturally curious about that. But I think that we are all also kind of trained to think that because we live in a smaller community that, oh, not really much is going on here. It's not really worth your time. Or, you know what, you know, Chicago's where interesting things are happening and where interesting people are. So yeah. How we get students not just the platform to ask those questions, but the confidence to say that, like, my community is worth investing that kind of inquiry in.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's really well said, Peter. And even your experience reflects how diverse rural areas are, how teaching can be sharing these questions together. That question is just so nuanced and even unanswered in a lot of ways of what is rural. And man, doing this whole process has made us absolutely confront this idea of maybe this rural deficit kind of thinking that my students are, especially in towns where the amenities are declining. What does it mean to grow up there in a town where your mascot is the miners, right? But yet you haven't seen the mines have been shut down for 20 years. The factories that there's this like a big international harvester plant in our area. Still rings this bell, like this bell survived a fire. And it's very like culturally nostalgic for a lot of people in the area. But for young people, I mean, what does it mean for them? They're not going to work at this factory that maybe mom and dad or grandpa worked at. And so growing up, there's this deficit thinking that success is something that happens somewhere else. And it's funny how you give students the reins to just ask questions that they're curious about, and you end up confronting those thinkings. And really one of the best rural assets that we have, well, without saying, I think our rural assets is our young people, right, growing up in these areas. But also this idea of community connections. And this is kind of where we started this conversation, I think, a little bit of just the rural superpower of being community connected. How my students don't always have to be maybe cogs in a wheel and a system and an institution of get your credit hours, get your seat time, that they really can share a lot of their questions and think about some of the problems that our community has. And they can do it with other people beyond the walls of our school that have the knowledge, that have the experience, certainly more than I do. So a lot of things to kind of think about when it comes to what I love about this show that you have is there's a lot of thinking about the purpose of education today, how it's changing, how we can best support our students. It's funny because all this really just came up with just questions, right? Just kind of starting with that.
Yeah, and again, like, some advantages that might come with being in a rural community, especially for this project, right? Like, being in a rural area, maybe the people that can answer those questions you have, maybe they're a little bit more accessible. Maybe you can actually find those people and get those people on the line a little bit easier. But yeah, I mean, like, it is so interesting to be like, okay, like how can we fit local history into what we do? Because again, like that's just not many people's experience going to school was. I don't think most people remember there being much of any talk about their, you know, A, local history, but B, why local history or why the culture of your area is important and worth considering on like a really like academic lens, right? Like important, not just like, oh, we've got this one off where we're going to see who the guy the library is named after is, but just like an actual, like we're going to devote a lot of time to this.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a quote I like from a lady. I want to share this. Her name's Pamela Riney Kerberg. She's really turned into a friend of this podcast that we do, but she wrote a book about growing up on the countryside, like farm kids growing up. And she has this quote that says the economics up and downs of rural places have done little to encourage youngsters raised in the country to stay. We build roads that lead away rather than toward our rural spaces. And so as we all have this nuanced, rich rural history that we all really do have to do our own reckoning with. You know, Sandwich has stories about the fairs. They have some beautiful things that need to be harbored, need to be preserved in a newer way that maybe speaks to people in a more meaningful way today, which I love doing. I love giving my kids opportunities to think about, is it just a marker that we need somewhere about something to highlight? Or is it something more interactive that would really speak to people, to get them to reflect, to question, what is the purpose of preserving your history? But some hard things really come up that we have to reckon with. Whatever this stuff means, if we're going to get a chance for young people to stay and be invested in the community, we've got to give them a space to ask these questions. And I don't mean to be nerdy about the design of school and the history of school, but just doing this.
I mean, if ever there were a platform to be nerdy about that, though, you are in the right place.
This is the right platform, yeah. But it just kind of reveals that we are still part of a system of doing school that was built for a different time, you know? And I think it's been a whole, at least my experience in teaching has kind of been this, man, I think I might be this generation in transition. And so, and this might not be appropriate for this podcast, but it has given me a lot to think about of rural areas are certainly sometimes we're a little bit like, you know, there's jet lag, but we might be a little bit like cultural lag sometimes. Maybe traditionally we were the last to kind of hear about, I don't know, the Macarena or something or some new hip trendy thing. But I'm telling you, when it comes
we
to
just
the,
got the Macarena in 2010 in Sandwich. Yeah.
Did you? Yeah, I don't know why I said that. That was weird. But this, but we might sometimes be the last in this, but I really think we're the first to kind of experience the sort of burdens of needing to change the way that we do school to be a much more student-centered, thinking about the sort of skills that we want to see in our students, that they can have a space to address the issues that we need to, address today. And so, yeah, a lot of those things come up. But again, just going back to just giving my students a space to ask their own questions. I mean, so many things come up.
Yeah. How do you give them the confidence to do that, right? Like so many people, like I don't have to tell you that, like, obviously, A, public speaking freaks out so many people. B, just like doing interviews with people also, I'm sure for a lot of folks, they're super nervous about that. So again, like not just the confidence to come up with the questions, but to go out, explore, ask people those questions, feel confident about it. How does that, like, how has that kind of evolved over the course of doing this project?
Yeah, man, such a great question. The first thing I think about, don't you, is and I'm probably also revealing most of my experience in education, although rural areas afford me to work with, I've worked with everybody from pre-K all the way through adult, but primarily I work with that secondary age. And by the time they get there, isn't it interesting that the questions have already been kind of pushed out? And I don't know if it's we just get into sort of compliance mode. So a lot of this is really just what I find is when students have the space to do this, it's they also are given a space to kind of know themselves, understand themselves. And I'm not so sure, Peter, I think I've even started moving away from it's okay if you're not ready to I want you to grow in that, but it's okay if you're not ready to communicate in this kind of form that me and you are definitely fond of.
Yeah, for sure.
But know about yourself and where is your voice? How are you going to share your thinking and that matters? And so even podcasting is one medium in sharing your reflections on a conversation or how you're going to address a question. Maybe that's not for you, but a way of
what
you
other
still
different
have to
places
share your
could
voice.
There be?
Yeah. Well, you're talking to a guy who my mom was a music teacher And she was one of my favorite teachers. My other favorite teacher is my wife. She's an art teacher. And so I think this is where that generation of creatives come in, is maybe it's a space where in some questions that they are choosing a different kind of medium to reflect in. And there is nothing like just giving a student a space, you know, as we've had some foundational knowledge, some things to think about. And as you reflect on the answer, maybe their answer comes in a form of artwork, but that artwork does need to be displayed and you do need to have a responsibility to communicate it in some way. And so I've had students make some art and then make a little, back then it was like Flipgrid, but maybe we just use Padlet or something where they make a video of their reflection, their thinking, and it is an absolute battle. And maybe you lost the battle. Maybe the kid just didn't turn the camera on, but I'm telling you, that student grew from where they were to where they are now. They became becoming a better person. And maybe we're always just becoming a better person. That's something I wrestle with. How do I know these outcomes are successful? You know, in an era where we're still just communicating success through a traditional assessment score, right? Those are good goals, but I think they're too small.
And even the opposite way, right? Like if you're making, you know, a form of media that's going to be distributed, the obvious and the only other like metric of success that often gets weighed is like, how far was your reach? Did you, you know, again, like kind of clicks and views and things like that, which also has absolutely nothing to do with the quality of the product itself.
Yeah. I tell you what, and I love that you mentioned journalism. I should have anticipated that this would come out, but that is, I think that is our primary, one of the primary purposes of a true skill that our students must inherit, is this sort of becoming a skeptical consumer of information, constantly questioning how do they know what they know. And this is the work of journalism. And my students also, when it comes to communicate effectively, is maybe this kind of skill that we're saying, I want them to do a lot more listening. I want them to kind of pause and sit with their questions. I have noticed, and one thing that's kind of helped me have the courage of letting go maybe some traditional ways of just being a sharer of knowledge, you know, which I do, going back to 07 was my first year. I haven't really reflected too much on this, but I really was part of that movement of, what was it? You know, the No Child Left Behind era, we needed to produce teachers that were highly qualified teachers. And so what that meant for me as a history social science guy is I took a class in like psychology and sociology and world geography. And now I've earned that certificate to impart this knowledge as a highly qualified teacher. And I really think it's been a lot of unlearning that, right? What does that mean now in an era where kids are, I'm telling you, the students know so much from watching videos of presidential trivia on YouTube. You know, I mean, they have so much access to it. So what does that mean for a teacher today? So it's been a transition into kind of learning that approach and to this foundational knowledge that we're trying to acquire. How do we know it's reliable? How do we know it's true? And Peter, man, the journalism, there's another whole podcast about my students are also growing up in those news deserts where who is the holder of that local information. And are we okay with it being Facebook? You know, is that appropriate? And finally, how are we talking to each other? How do we talk to people? My students are seeing so many object lessons of just really poor examples of how to be in conversation, how to truly feel like someone is listened to and that they matter and that their story isn't forgotten or are invisible. So a lot of random things to unpack there as I think about your nod to journalism before.
Yeah, for sure. And again, like it seems like what you said, that a lot of this project has also been examining your own like relationship with education. What does it mean to be a teacher in 2025 when there's access to so much information? But, you know, it's difficult to find the kind of context that you need for that information and be able to, you know, have like a guiding hand to deliver that information to students. And like the journalism thing, I think is fascinating, right? That in some ways your project is kind of a local journalism outlet in a lot of ways, or local history outlet for sure too. And I think about how it also kind of speaks to this larger role that I think schools can have, especially in rural communities, right? Like they become kind of cultural hubs in ways that just don't, you know, isn't necessary and doesn't really happen in maybe a larger community or maybe an urban or suburban community where, again, talk about like, you know, local arts, like you mentioned with you know, your wife as an arts teacher, right? Like, think about how in a rural community there might not be very many venues for, you know, live performance. The school ends up becoming that. Like, there's so much talent in those schools. Local live sports becomes the same thing, and almost the same thing for you guys. Where in a news desert, sometimes, you know, you guys are also kind of become, you know, part of the kind of local journalism, local history part of that too, is, you know, part of that larger kind of cultural hub that school can be in those communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the idea of just inviting our students to even kind of share in what can the news look like? What can our community look like? And even just a general, why are we doing what we're doing when we gather and share. There's so much to think about. And I didn't mean to just totally nerd out to how we do school, but I have found, you know, just trying to do this approach, it has kind of revealed definitely some of the assets, but also some of the things that really do need to shift to really make things like this flourish.
Yeah, I think it's like, again, I think that in 2025, especially with social media, and you mentioned like students being, you know, maybe more disengaged, and there's so many distractions. And I think especially coming out of the pandemic, right, there's so much isolation that people want to feel like they're part of a community, and that, you know, maybe school can help them do that, right? And like, again, feel like not just their school community, but, you know, their local community, right? That they can feel like they're involved and engaged, and they're talking to people, and that they're, you know, a part of a larger group.
Yeah. And then even to go on, how do you know when you're successful, when you've achieved that? That's another question I think we all have to be asking as all the stakeholders in our community. And maybe just to touch briefly on, I was sharing before about this kind of work from a rural context. Rural schools, and why it comes out so much is, again, rural schools are incredible assets, but they really do feel the burden of a system that needs to change, I think, more than most. Operating beyond capacity is a norm. It's a norm here. There is all kinds of shared, and I know every rural school, every rural community is different, but there is still a collective shared problems of staffing shortages, limited access to different kind of resources. I know the current principal I have, she's the principal, but she's really is also the guidance counselor. She's the special ed director. I caught her pulling weeds the other day. I mean, for crying out loud, like they're doing a lot.
I'm sure she substitutes like bus driving sometimes too.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the same with classroom teachers. You know, we're all teaching multiple subjects. They're the department heads. They're coaching all the sports, sponsoring all the clubs, doing all kinds of fundraisers. But saying that though, there's still incredible fertile ground for innovation in these places. And I think that's one of the things that I'm also trying to express when I say I love being in a rural area, because it is a fun time. If you're a builder, if you're a designer, if you're an innovator, it's a fun time to be asking questions. Yes, you do need to come to grips with some of the realities about the needs to change, but relationships with stakeholders beyond just your own classroom, whether it's other teachers, parents, businesses, those relationships are so important to building the kind of system of education we need. And they're the superpower in these parts. They really, it's not hard at all to make a meaningful connection to someone, kind of share their knowledge and share their wisdom with students. So that's one thing I really do probably enjoy most, is that kind of, yes, there are some challenges here, but there really is a lot of autonomy. That's a good word for it. Autonomy to kind of try different approaches.
Right. So like you said, like, obviously, you know, people that listen to the show are familiar with like staffing challenges in schools. And like you mentioned, people have got a lot of hats on. People are trying to, you know, in a lot of ways, just day to day, keep their head above water. And so in that way, it can be difficult to be like, on top of just getting everything done I need to get done, I want to think about things in a new way and try to innovate. But it is really cool for you to say that, like, again, because you are in a smaller community, that it is maybe a little bit easier to be able to make some changes, because you can communicate with those stakeholders pretty quickly. And maybe there isn't quite as much, like, you know, red tape or bureaucracy to start getting that going as there might be in another place.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's a great quick story. Just to prove this point, is we had a young man named Braxton who had a lot of questions about mining, in our town. He wasn't originally from this area, but he moved here and noticed he was living on some old strip mining land. And we found out this rumor that Cuba was the strip mining capital of the world, but there's nothing to kind of like declare this. But we were at one time, Cuba, Illinois, where we live, the strip mining capital of the world. So he had all kinds of questions for this, especially, you know, why don't we hear that more? Is that something that we should kind of brag about, have a claim to it? And well, there is a man that is our mining expert, local mining expert. He's the old retired history teacher. This guy's name is Mr. Maori, and he is just done with public presentations. He's getting older, and he's like, Joe, I love you, but I just don't want to come out to school anymore. I'm tired of giving public presentations, and he's ready to pass that torch. But we really need Braxton to go and visit his house. He's got all the equipment. He's got all the stories. He's got all the memorabilia in his house, but it's too hard to just get there. Well, Braxton is a working fool. He works a couple jobs. He's played sports all year round. How is this man going to get permission to do this in a space where he's got to get his high school graduation credits done? You know, and then when school's done, he's got to go to practice. He's got to go to work. And we're in rural areas. So practice for a lot of kids in rural areas, they're not getting home until 7 o'clock. You know, I mean, it's a bit of a bus ride. So the best thing happened is Braxton broke his leg. He broke his leg playing football, and he got permission for a couple of weeks to take off PE and go and visit Mr. Maori. And just kind of this, like, didn't have to be a cog in a wheel. And he had these wonderful conversations. And there was really this sort of passing of a torch and help preserve this history. And a quick funny end of that story is he found out one of the big reasons why, and I hope this story is okay to say on this show, one of the big reasons why we didn't have a strip mining sign anymore, welcome to Cuba, strip mining capital of the world, is he discovered, I guess, there was some vandalism, some local boys who are much now older men who still kind of laugh at this, but they vandalized the sign and they changed the word so it said, welcome to Cuba, the stripping capital of the world. And so the sign just kind of went, had to get taken down.
I could
down.
See how that could happen for teenagers, yeah, for sure.
Yes, the memory sort of faded, but the work he did, and he was able to kind of pinpoint why we could make that claim, what kind of production that we had, how these businesses, it's a really complicated history to learn about strip mining stuff. But yeah, it was a wonderful to see that sort of take place that might not happen at a lot of schools. You might get maybe lost in some bureaucracy or some kind of strict requirements, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, that reminds me, I was listening to your appearance on the 21st show with a couple of your former students, a show that I've been on a couple times too.
Oh, cool.
And they were, one of the students was talking about how, you know, when you ask these questions, it often leads you to the next series of questions and the next story. And I think, again, to bring it back to journalism, this has happened so much to me, where you set out to answer one question and then that just kind of leads you to a different hallway with other doors in there. And then you have to decide, you know, what are the next questions I want to go to? I imagine that's something that you've seen play out quite Absolutely. A bit over with the project, that one question just ends up leading to more and more, which again, kind of just builds curiosity up and up.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the young ladies that were on that show with me, Katie and Courtney, they were much a part of them. Yeah, shout out to Katie and Courtney. And they had some specific questions about this Fort Gatonia story, and the governor of Fort Gatonia, this Neil Gam guy, who's absolutely hilarious, by the way. If anybody wants a YouTube, he was on a show, the History Channel show, How the States Got Their Shape. And he is, it's one of the funniest segments of that show is when they cover this Fort Gatonia story. And there's just so many stories about like that. This small town guy just kind of was really hilarious and enthusiastic and just kind of had that eccentric personality. Well, Neil Gam passed away in 2012. And so to learn about him, they were actually finding his friends. They were finding other family, you know, kind of who else can we learn and talk to about these problems? And so that was how they framed the story. But it was interesting. They had an older brother who his questions that they thought they started out to answer their brother's questions. Their brother had much more hard history questions about our sundown town heritage. And it's really interesting to see how students, and that's a normal thing for rural teachers, is you just don't have to learn a lot of names. You just know these students forever. And so I've had several, you know, siblings. It was interesting how siblings have kind of continued the questions that older siblings were asking, but maybe framed them in a different way. And Peter, man, this probably happens to you in journalism a lot too, but sometimes those students find out that access to the answers to those are sometimes guarded or sometimes not welcomed. One of my favorite examples is a young lady named Ella, who is just the nicest, sweetest young lady. She she asked some questions about her favorite museum. We live not far from the Dixon Mounds Museum. And there was a pretty major protest in the early 90s because the remains of the human remains that were thousands of years old, they were still open to the public. And so there was a significant protest, and this story made significant news. But it's really hard to get folks to talk about that. They don't want to feel like they're speaking ill of their town in a small town. And so she got a little frustrated too in a way that I thought was still so healthy for learning when you have questions, you know. And I've been uncomfortable too. I know we're in an era too for a lot of us as social studies and history folks, especially in civics, we're sometimes really guarded. And man, is asking that question gonna get me to lose my job? Or, you know, we're in an era where there's accusations of indoctrinating students and things like this. Well, I've had nothing but a community that's, you know, for the most part welcome these things. But I'll tell you, the things that have made me most uncomfortable or when students ask questions about local crime stories, are looking into why, you know, there's a scholarship or there's a picture of a person that says in memoriam, but how did that person die? And what you end up dealing with is a lot of folks that are still holding trauma from some local crimes that we shared as a community. And it's maybe some things that's kind of healthy to ask difficult questions so we can kind of wrestle with this and finding meaning from it today and learn really about that person. But curiosity can be a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I've seen it unite our town, but I've also seen it can be an uncomfortable thing as well too. But the most important thing for me is not arriving at specific answers. It's that we are developing the kind of skills to be the human beings that we need to carry on our communities forward.
Yeah, I think you're right that I think, and again, like maybe this is just me as a journalist, you know, surprise, surprise, touting the horn of how good journalism can be for people, right? Like, not surprising. But I do, and I remember being in college, and when I was taking my first couple journalism classes, the thing that stuck out to me is, again, just telling stories in a community and interviewing people. It just opens you up to the fact that everyone, and this sounds so cliche to say, but truly, yeah, that everyone has a story to tell. And that, you know, again, when, and not just that that everyone has a story, but again, everyone has a story that's worth telling. And, you know, you think about your own life and you think about the, you know, your own family and everyone, you know, how the thousands of fascinating stories that you have of, you know, family history or things like that. And it just, again, I think it opens you up to a level of curiosity and empathy that even beyond, you know, you may or may not grow up to be a journalist. It's kind of irrelevant at that point, but just having those skills of kind of empathy, seeing yourself and other people and being curious about the people in your life and your community, I think is just a good thing to have.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's for me growing up, and I might have mentioned this on that that 21st show, I'm not sure if I did, but maybe a bit of a frustration for me is oftentimes this you know, podcast can be viewed as, we often do this for teachers, is view, oh, that's really cool, but that's just that pet project that teacher's doing.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, but developing empathy in a young person, that's important work. You know, how important is that really? How much do we value that? And then how do we know that we're achieving it? How do we know when we realize it?
How do you measure success in developing empathy? What does that even mean?
And maybe this journalism, this kind of approach, or I like to think of it as maybe kind of a more civic, which is something that we all share. That's an interdisciplinary kind of these approaches. But this idea of how do you teach someone to really listen to someone else's stories, to make that, give a space where you are asking questions, but that space is about that person. And when you acknowledge these Forgottonia stories, that other people's exist, and that their stories are worth listening to, you start slowly seeing a young person develop into the kind of person you want it to be. And so I don't know, I look at like those students that were on 21st show, Katie Courtney, a lot of the other students that I've mentioned, that I could share so much more about the stories that they've looked into. For me, the success is kind of seeing them just develop, just trying to grow and to think and to listen. And probably the coolest thing I think I've ever done as a teacher, and God knows I have made a lot of mistakes, this whole process has really been probably more about me as a teacher learning to let go, to really trust my students, but to also share the education, the burdens of education with the community. And so one of my favorite things I've learned to do was invite a class to the coffee shop in Cuba, and we listened to some of the old timers. And one of my favorite old timers is he's actually my neighbor, lives across the street, is a guy named Peck Hart. Peck just turned 100 years old. He's a veteran of two wars. So World War II and Korea, he's a veteran of. He's probably one of the last like traditional miners in our town with this lived experience of how rough and oftentimes dangerous that work was. I mean, he's lost some folks close to him doing this work. But he is such an energetic, enthusiastic guy. I mean, we're talking, it's probably like 110 degrees outside, but I'm pretty sure I can hear him mowing his lawn right now. I mean, he is just an energetic guy. But he meets up at the coffee shop with some friends every morning. And so the best thing to do is to sort of bring my students there and just learn from his lived experiences, to see them ask some questions. And he always shares some stories. He gives some advice about how important education is to put food on your table today, you know, how proud he is of the community, and kind of like something happens there that's really, really important. And I think it's about developing. We're trying to just develop the kind of human beings that, again, we want to see, to share in the joys and the struggles of continuing on the legacy of all these wonderful small towns we have throughout Illinois.
Yeah. And again, it feels like, you know, one of the big things at the core of this project is wrestling with and responding to that big question of how do we get rural youth to stay and invest and have a stake in their community. And, you know, obviously there are some questions and some things that we're not going to be able to answer throughout that, right? Like some big economic things that like we're probably not going to be able to solve in a year or two.
Yeah.
But getting those students again to see their communities as rich places full of like, you know, rich and interesting people, and like that civic part of it, if it being again not just there's stories to tell, but that those stories are important. I think that, you know, if anything, you're seeing at least helping your students see their community as a more like three-dimensional place.
Absolutely. Yeah. And at least look back to what are those memorable learning experiences that we can create, you know? And I can't say, even looking back at my school experiences, I remember that, you know, traditional lesson where I took notes and then took a test or something, and creating those learning experiences. At least they remember that stuff, and they're going to remember some of these things. And maybe down the road, if they have this experience where they need to leave and gain some skills, gain some experience, maybe they're more likely to bring that back here and apply some of that knowledge here. That might be a goal that we need to articulate and think about how we might measure that outcome. But, you know, as we talked about journalism too, you just reminded me, I've had a couple students that have done this, these podcast projects, and they really got into journalism. They did a lot of independent kind of things, and they went and studied somewhere, and they really are, I would love to come back in small towns, but it is probably one of those big problems we're also inheriting, not just rural youth leaving, but where is that journalism career to kind of latch onto when you're here in that space? And so that's one thing where they've had no choice but to sort of to have a livable income, you know, to go to a more metropolitan area. But that said, maybe I should give a shout out to it's called the Forgottonia Times. Some young professionals have just created their own newspaper around here that's in a 4-county area. It's not representing all 16 counties, but that's something that has been wonderful to see, to try to fill in the gaps of some of those news holes that we've seen. And it's a wonderful thing that's been all young professionals that have kind of taken on that initiative.
And again, so, grabbing a hold of that Forgottonia term again.
Yeah, using that, which is funny. It's because there probably are some folks that you talk to that still use it in a very much kind of angry way of, we still are ignored, we are not getting our fair share. But there really is a wonderful, endearing term. There's been, I think, a guy saw that segment on the History Channel of Neil Gam, How the States Got Their Shape, and he ended up writing a musical about Forgottonia that was playing in St. Louis for a while. So there's been a musical. There's a musician named Chris Valillo that's just released an album of music inspired, you know, kind of by this region. A guy named Bruce Morton has a wonderful photography. And probably my favorite, unfortunately, they just closed, but there's a local brewery in Macomb called the Forgottonia Brewery, named for this. They it's really tough to have a brewery in this part of the world. But they were definitely kind of a cultural hub for a while. All kinds of things about this Forgottonia name.
I think it's so cool again, because I just, you know, again, I grew up in a place that we just didn't have like a cool like cultural signifier like that, right? I mean, yeah, like yeah. That gives you that kind of sense of identity and community, even in a broader, vague way, because it's like, well, we're certainly not Chicago. We're not even the Chicago suburbs, just like rural northern Illinois. We should, it would be, I would love to have had a, yeah. We need a term.
Yeah, and that spirit too, that spirit of making what appears to be invisible or unassuming, but to make it more visible or into that public conscious. I mean, I can sound off all day about some of my favorite local history and some of the cultural things here, but the truth is every community has that. They have their own rich heritage and rich stories. I like to call like folks like Peck Hart, the 100-year-old neighbor I have, I like to call folks like him unforgettable Fort Gatonians. But the truth is every community has such assets and such wisdom just kind of waiting there to be discovered. And it's also kind of a play-based approach when you do it too. You're likely to have more engagement if students can kind of have the freedom to sort of discover that. But yeah, Fort Gatonia, that feeling of being invisible or unknown. I often give an analogy of prom. You know, it's not the worst thing if you ask someone to prom and they say no. The worst thing is when you ask them and they have no idea you exist. They don't say anything, you know? That's that kind of feeling. And that feeling really is everywhere. And so for a young person to sort of discover a story and to make it more known, to give, even if it's just their grandparents, the microphone. Shout out to StoryCorps. If anybody's out there has heard of StoryCorps, those kinds of things that we're doing are absolutely wonderful to get them to reflect on a piece of history that matters to them. And what does it mean for them today as they're navigating this journey of life that we're on, you know?
Yeah. Well, before we get out of here, Joey, I do have to ask, we always ask people about their own kind of teacher origin story and how they got into this. You mentioned that your mom was a teacher. I was curious for you, is teaching something that you had wanted to do since you were younger? Was it something that came to you a little bit later on in school? Like, how did you come to it?
Yeah, great story. So I'm really actually inspired by my dad. I kind of came into education inspired by my dad. Imagine this, picture this. It was 9/11. 9/11 happened. I was a senior in high school, and my dad was actually an Army recruiter. And so talk about the pressure of just a lot of people were joining. My dad put about four or five of my friends in the Army. My all my uncles were in the Army. My older brother was in the Army, served in Iraq. And my dad knew how much I loved school. And he had such esteem for teachers. I mean, he married a teacher, for crying out loud.
I'd hope so.
I remember my dad was, for a while, he was the head of the National Guard in my area. And I remember as a kid, we'd go to stores, grocery stores, and random people would salute my dad. And I thought my dad was this really big deal. And to be honest, his day job, he was like a bus driver, transportation guy. For a while, he was like a security guard, but he was a really proud member of the armed forces. But my dad encouraged me to be a teacher. He talked about how important this is as service. And he talked about how we really need to be doing that same kind of feeling for teachers. Like if you should have teachers walk around and get saluted, you know, that esteem for teachers. So I still remember going to my mom's classroom. She got her own classroom and dreaming about that day I could get my own classroom. And I mean, I was not getting paid a lot my first year, but I was so ecstatic because I'm like, I can't believe they just gave me my classroom. I have my own classroom, you know? And so for me, it really was an absolute dream job. I think there's some other lessons in there too about attracting and sustaining people to the profession so it can kind of maintain that. Because I probably shouldn't have been as excited for like, you know, pay and things like that I was getting that first year. But the joy of having that and the inspiration of what it means for our society to be teachers. Maybe I can end with where we started, how much I love this space that you're giving to elevate the experiences of teachers, the role, what it means for our communities. And I just don't think we're doing that enough. So kudos to you, sir.
All right, Joey. Well, thanks so much, man, for taking the time to have this conversation. I'm sure that we could probably go another 2 hours into more existential questions about education and journalism, yeah. But we'll spare folks from that. That'll be the extended version of the podcast, the director's cut.
Yeah, there you go. A bonus episode.
Exactly.
So, well, thanks for enduring my rambles and rants about the purposes of education and things like this, but...
Again, if ever there were a platform for it, you're in the right place. So no need to apologize at all.
All right. Sounds great. Well, so great talking with you, sir.
Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always,
feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Joey. Send them our way to teachersLounge@niu.edu. And please continue to send your story ideas too, so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, or share. It's the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. And a big thanks to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ups for the music you hear each and every episode of the show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin, and we will be back with more Teachers Lounge very soon. See ya.